man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hey, 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 how's it going, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, If You Wadiwe, in the virtual booth with me are my friends. And let me introduce you to all them friends. First up, we have Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Oh, Iffy, so many things. Just so many things are so good right now. I'm going to say Swedish Mac, which is a thing I didn't know existed and now, frankly, can't live without. It's basically a macaroni and cheese recipe that involves tomato sauce and ground beef. It could not be more like church social covered dinner kind of thing, and it is so comforting and so awesome. And Dave just made it for the first time, and it's gonna be it's totally entering the rotation.
Ooh. That sounds like homemade hamburger helper.
It is
which
exactly
is a compliment.
That
which is a yeah. compliment yeah yeah
but
yeah.
You know, but the less processed kind, you know, you can feel good. You can buy like the really expensive canned tomatoes and simmer them down to sauce if you feel like it, but yeah, ultimately that's what it is, and it is so what I needed right now.
It's the hamburger helper you'd get from an IKEA.
Boom.
Well, that second voice you hear giving us those hamburger helper pro tips is Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
The second voice that's incapable of not butting in.
That voice? First voice? Yes.
That's this gal. Okay, so what is good for me is interesting because it's adjacently related to our guest today who had introduced me to what was previously my favorite offering on YouTube that I've talked about on the show before, which is Jewel and Jessica Simpson singing, "How Do You Save My Soul? How Do I Save Your Soul?" Whatever. I've already told people to Google.
Who will save your soul?
Thank you, Alonzo. Yes, classic music.
Spoiler, no souls are saved
no
in this video.
No souls are saved. It's the most soulless duet you've ever seen. However, this week, what is good
they're
with me...
They're saving it.
Yes, they're saving it. This week, what is good with me is my new favorite offering, which is a part of the Harper's Bazaar series where they ask celebrities, basically, what do you eat in a day? And Ms. Tyra Banks did a What I Eat in a Day. It is 6 minutes and 40 seconds of incredible nonsense. She is 100% an alien wearing a human suit. I also fully believe that she not only rehearsed her answers, but that she had like an acting coach practice them, and then she memorized the line delivery of a comedic acting coach. I cannot encourage you fast enough to please just go find this little pocket of escapism and madness, and you will also never eat bagels and cream cheese the same way again. Oh my God.
Is it the new Welcome to My Home?
Oh my God. It's so welcome. It is so good. It is so weird. Oh, I love it. That is what's good.
All right. And we also have writer and host of the Call Your Girlfriend podcast, Ann Friedman. What's good?
Well, I have something extremely good to talk about, which is sort of the soul equivalent of a fancy mac and cheese, but can be found on YouTube. So I think I'm splitting the difference between the other recommendations we've heard, which is the Great Pottery Throwdown. It is a BBC show that is stylistically similar to the Great British Bake Off. However, they make ceramics. And if you thought baking was like maybe a little too intense, like, I don't know, there's like just too much going on with like measuring the flour and whatever, and you want more hand-drawn pottery sketches, or if you like to see people hand-build toilets out of clay, I highly recommend this show. And I find it, I mean, I would have found it soothing anyway, but something about this moment, because if you're making ceramics, things crack and break all the time. You know, like everything's always drying wrong and breaking in the kiln. And all they do is comfort each other. All they do is just like help each other get through these like minor, like creative problems. And nothing has soothed my soul more in this moment than the Great Pottery Throwdown.
Well, like, I haven't seen The Bake Off yet, but that's kind of been the one takeaway I've heard everyone talk about, is like, it's a competition, but everyone still helps each other. Like, it's not as, and
yeah, they also, did come here to make friends.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And I am so wanted, I'm here for it. That is apparently a genre. Here to Make Friends is a genre of television I actually truly love, because I am cheesy like that.
Iffy, what's good?
He's so quick on the draw now. Iffy, Alonzo wants to know what's good. Yeah,
what's good with me is, you know, I rocked the anime world online when I revealed that the only Miyazaki film that I saw was Ponyo. I thought, you know, I knew my film friends would be mad at me, but I didn't know the weebs online would be just as mad. So I went, and because I always got to do too much, I went and bought the whole Miyazaki collection on Blu-ray. It's gorgeous. It's great. It has Lupin the Third, which I didn't know he directed. Real hyped. But, you know, I started off with My Neighbor Totoro with Naomi. And I was afraid because, like, they get really detailed in Totoro's mouth when he, like, opens it. So I thought she would get scared, but she was in. She was, like, she loved it. She loved the big Totoro. She loved watching it. And that was when I also noticed that Miyazaki has, like, a lot of female-led films. So, like, Naomi was already in because, you know, she gets to watch these, like, little girls. And there are things that I've noticed in Miyazaki films that that I like that you don't see often in Western films, like in both, because we saw My Neighbor Totoro and we saw Kiki's Delivery Service.
That's the one I was going to recommend for her.
Yeah. Yeah, she fell asleep halfway, but she still was enjoying it until she got too sleepy. But with that, is like, I noticed that, like, the dick character that all children films have, like in Miyazaki films, they're a dick and then you just move past them. Like, there's never no, like, coming back to get the one up. It's like, no. And I like that because that's real life. Like, people who are assholes are just going to be there and you're never going to get the chance to be like, aha, I did. You doubted me. Like, if you go up to a person who was like, you're never going to make it, and tell them that you did, they'd be like, okay. Yeah. Like, there's never going to be like this triumphant moment. So I like that. It's like, yeah, you just move past them and you keep doing the cool thing that you were trying to do.
There's a little of that in Spirited Away, which Naomi might be a little young for at this point, but it's probably still my favorite of his movies.
Ooh, see, I'm watching that and you're the second one that everyone's like, watch it. Might not around Naomi. Like, I already know Princess Mononoke is not.
Oh, no,
Naomi,
no,
because the cover is just this bloody woman and wolf. And I need to know
later.
All right, y'all. Today's show, we're talking about Never Rarely Sometimes Always. We're gonna take a call from the Who Shot line, and of course, we got some staff picks. But first, we have a new segment on our show. With movie production halted and release dates getting pushed back, our news sources for It Addicts segment have run dry. It's a desert. So, while we're all socially distancing and recording remotely, we're introducing a brand new segment called This Is Your Movie Live. If you could tell, I did get a cold, which, imagine getting a cold now. Very, very stressful. So in the coming weeks, we will take a voyage through our lives to discuss the films that shaped who we are today. And since this is the second week, we're going to be discussing our middle school years. Alonzo, would you please begin?
Sure. So, you know, I was, you know, pretty much from about fourth grade onward, like almost every weekend, I was dragging some friend or other of mine to go to the movies. And, you know, it was a very mixed bag of stuff. But when I think back to my middle school years were basically 78 and 79. And so a couple that leaped to mind, one was the comedy Foul Play with Chevy Chase and Goldie Hawn, which felt very sophisticated. I really hadn't seen that many screwball comedies, or like, I hadn't seen the movies that it was borrowing from flagrantly. You know, I hadn't seen enough Hitchcock yet. I hadn't, you know, caught up with a lot of these other movies. So to me, it all felt new and fresh, but, you know, a lot of fun, that great Dudley Moore cameo, and of course, a Barry Manilow theme song, you can't go wrong. One movie that Dave and I just watched that he'd never seen before, that's out on Criterion, is Robert Zemeckis' debut feature, I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is about a quartet of teenage girls from New Jersey coming to New York City when the Beatles are going to make their appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. And it holds up. It's delightful. It's charming. It's total boomer nostalgia. But as a early wave Gen Xer, I kind of pretty much grew up with my entire childhood being suffused with boomer nostalgia. So it didn't strike me at the time that was anything weird.
Did you say that was Zemeckis?
Yeah, Robert Zemeckis' first movie. He and Bob Gale co-wrote it after they had written 1941, which was still gestating. Spielberg came in
Speaking
as executive producer
boomer
on this
nostalgia.
One. Yeah, no kidding. But the big movie for me and for like America of that period would have to be Grease. A movie I saw I don't know how many times in the theater and owned the soundtrack, and it was just all there was at that moment. It was such a phenomenon and such a huge, huge thing. You know, in a movie now that obviously has its problematic nature and just starting with the fact that like all the teenagers are played by 30-year-olds. But you know, it was a huge thing at the time, and weirdly enough, probably wound up like, you know, helped cement my love for actual musicals of earlier periods. But that was sort of a good entry point.
Like, we all grew up with kid musicals. You have your Sound of Music, your Wizard of Oz, like the stuff that was on TV. But Grease was something that was like teenagers and quote unquote teenagers. And it was sexy. And it is one of those things, if you just look at the actual script of it, the sexual double entendres are out of control in that movie. Like,
it's horny High School Musical.
It truly is. But it's like horny, but written by like, if the horniness had been run through a Catskills comedian in the 60s, like, what do you think? I can't even think of any of it, but it's so good.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, matches the ending of Cats with your heroes floating into the sky.
Oh my
God.
You
are the Jellicle choice, Olivia Newton-John.
Okay, Drea, what pick are you going with?
Well, first, it's important to me to clarify that in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, which is where I moved to and began this part of my academic career, we had junior highs, not middle schools. And an important distinction, because as a 12-year-old, you felt much cooler going to junior high than middle school. At least this 12-year-old did, and not much else made her feel cool, so I was grabbing on. Actually, and that's a perfect segue to the film that I picked that dominated a lot of my junior high viewing, because it imagined a high school future for me that was as terrifying as I imagined high school, but I also kind of wanted to emulate parts of it, and that would be the motion picture Heathers. Heathers was so, oh my God, like, obviously I wanted to be Veronica, the Winona Ryder character. I had a real, it introduced me to the complications of having a crush on a person like JD, which is the Christian Slater, and then having to get to the end of it and be like, not great choices. Maybe I don't have any intuition when it comes to who to like. And then I ignored that for a few decades. But I loved Heathers. I loved how they talked. I loved the rapport of it. Like, it has such delicious dialogue. I loved that it blew up and just kind of put in sharp relief all those high school hierarchies, which very much exist. And because it was so, like, dramatic and overly done, I was like, oh, this is fabulous. I can't wait till I get out of this junior high and I'm finally playing croquet with my friends. I also, my best recent costume, of which I might have to send a photo for this, was I went as Martha Dump Truck for Halloween a few years ago with one of my best friends, Saucy, whom Anne knows, who went as Veronica, and it was beautiful. And it was also heartbreaking because we went to West Hollywood Parade, and the amount of people who did not know who I was like, shocking to me.
Did you have a soda stained Big Fun shirt?
I did. Did I also have a neck brace? I'll send you a picture.
Please
it's amazing.
Do.
Yeah.
Yeah, if this segment gets us to our early 20s, then I'll bring up Heather's.
Okay. But,
you know. Ooh. All right, Anne, what you got for us, your middle school years?
Okay, generational caveats also apply. So I am like the oldest millennial, born 10 days into the millennial window. So like truly, like that's your context for my age. And when I thought about junior high, there are probably movies that I watched more, but like the very first and defining thing that came to mind was Speed.
Oh, yes.
Here's the thing. I had very, very few like celebrity crushes when I was growing up. Even as an adult, when people will have like, oh, you know, you can break the terms of our monogamy for this hypothetical celebrity. Like my list has always been very short. I just don't like lust after a celebrity figure.
Alan Ruck, right?
Listen, listen, you really got ahead of me on that one.
You're in her brain.
How did you know? But no, for real though, a true lifelong one and only Keanu Reeves situation is what we are faced with here. Mm. And you also have to understand that I grew up in a very conservative household. My parents found my VHS copy of Speed, which I think I bought from the bin at Family Video, you know, like after it had, you know, they had a million copies when it was huge and first out, that kind of thing. You could buy it for like very cheap. And they confiscated it because it was rated R and I was not allowed to watch rated R movies yet. Which is so funny to me because I think they were really trying to like protect me from sexual content and like of which there is none in Speed. Like there's one kiss on like a moving dolly type thing at the end. And like, that's literally it. And so and it's not even like actually that violent, which explains why I like it. Like I'm really not into super violent things. But every time I wanted to watch it, I had to go to my parents' bedroom and remove it from my father's like sock drawer, take it downstairs, put it in the VHS, watch it, and take it back upstairs and put it back in the sock drawer. And that is why it is a defining movie of my junior high years, because it is like illicit crush that I had to like go retrieve as if it were pornography from like my parents' bedroom.
I mean,
just to watch one kiss.
What's juicier at that age than forbidden love?
Like, yeah. That's how you create a lifelong obsession very easily. Yes.
Truly. That explains everything.
The R-rated movie I didn't get to see in junior high that all my friends did was Animal House.
Oh,
oh man.
Oh, thank God.
Much more risque than Speed. Much more.
Much more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Iffy, what about you?
For me, there are many movies that jump out to me at this time because there are so many good ones. This movie has changed the game. This movie is prolific. It is in the annals of cinematic achievements. It was The Matrix.
Oh, okay.
Every kid had to do the backwards trying to dodge a bullet because we saw that movie for some reason. And also we're keeping the Keanu Reeves loves in. You know, this was at the peak of his career. Every kid wanted to wear all black. This is what pushed, you know, millennial goths over the edge to cyber goth. You know, it's you know, bisexual awakenings all around. The Matrix, hands down. Like I look around and, you know, Sixth Sense was amazing. That blew my mind. That was my first choice. But it was The Matrix. That was the one that defined middle school because it just, everyone was so hyped. And, you know, we birthed many conspiracy theorists.
I really was hoping that very exuberant lead up was ramping towards you saying Space Jam.
Yeah, no, just all this, it's great, the annals of history, Star Wars Phantom Menace. You can't, you got it, you can't
get
enough of it.
Everybody's favorite Star Wars.
So basically, if he's dream girl is Carrie Ann Moss in glasses.
Yeah, yep.
And how's your lower back? Were you practicing that move all night?
Yeah, I was just trying to get ready.
You guys, we made it through our middle school / junior high years pretty okay.
Ooh. Yeah, yeah.
Pretty okay.
We did it. It's lots of great movies. And y'all should be hearing about lots of great podcasts when you hear from another show for Maximum Fun. And after that, we'll be right back.
O'Malley Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we host
Round Springfield.
Round Springfield is a new Simpsons podcast that is Simpsons adjacent. Mm-hmm. In its topic, we talk to Simpsons writers, directors, voiceover actors, you name it, about non-Simpsons things that they've done because, surprise, they're all extremely talented.
Absolutely. For example, David X. Cohen worked on The Simpsons, but then created a little show called Futurama.
Mm-hmm.
That's our very first episode. Yeah. So tune in for stuff like that with Yardley Smith, with Tim Long, with different writers and voice actors. It's going to be so much fun. And we are every other week on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, in the virtual stew with me are
Drea Clark,
Ann Friedman,
Alonzo Duralde.
And today we're talking about Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. Drea, would you mind providing us with a synopsis?
I would really like to give you a synopsis. So this is a film that takes place in Pennsylvania, and the lead character is a teenage girl named Autumn, who is working in sort of a, she's a cashier in a grocery store in what seems to be just a smaller, mid-sized, rundown town. Essentially a town that could be anywhere that's not a big urban center. Autumn starts the film with some illnesses and discovers she's pregnant. And when she goes to a local center and has that confirmed, she's also finds out that she can't get an abortion without parental consent in Pennsylvania. She's not sure what to do. Her cousin Skylar intervenes once she finds out that Autumn's pregnant, and the two of them take a trip to New York City where there are clinics that she can go to. Although even though that ends up taking longer, they run into a lot of issues bureaucratically, scheduling-wise, money-wise, transportation-wise, in the city, going through all of this. And it is a film by Eliza Hittman, who is a this is her third indie feature, and it stars a lot of unknown actors, and it premiered at Sundance this year. This is Never, Always, Never, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always.
Well, Drea, you had some like interesting questions to kind of start off this discussion. So do you want to hit us with one of them?
Sure. I feel like there's so much to look at in this film, which makes it one of my favorite kinds of films. But one thing that I thought was interesting just from the get-go, because it is dealing with a teenager who is trying to access abortion, but is also a very just sort of intimate story of these two cousins trying to navigate both the system and like a trip. Did you guys find this to be a political film? Would you describe it that way? Did you think of it that way?
For me, I would say no. Like it's that political is always fun for a fun conversation because I am one of those folks who believe all art is inherently political. But I think outside of that, if we're saying like they were going for it, it seems like it's more of just this self-contained story because there I feel like when stories like this try and be political, they try and make it more clear, like the different moving parts of it. And to me, it felt like it was like nothing. What was important about this was the act that was kind of happening. Like we didn't need to know about who she got pregnant by or like why she wanted to get rid of it. It just seemed like it was just a self-contained story.
And that's exactly why I thought it was political. Like it is a political choice to say, we don't need to know how this happened or even all of the ins and outs that went into her decision. All we need to know is that this is the choice that she made, that she is really committed to, and this is what it takes for her to see it through. And I don't think it is, I mean, listen, like given my beliefs about abortion access being what they are, it did not feel like, you know, this was striving for something political at the expense of story. I will say that.
Yeah.
But I did find myself wondering about how someone like my aforementioned conservative parents would watch this film and if they would think about it as just like propaganda or whether they would be able to kind of see it story first. And I don't know the answer to that, but for me, it's absolutely political.
Yeah, one of my favorite films on the subject is a Romanian movie that came out about 10 years ago called 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days. And what I thought was really interesting about the reception of that film in this country was that both anti-choice people and pro-abortion activists were able to sort of claim it as their own and say, oh, well, the film is speaking for us. And this one, I don't think is quite necessarily, you know, dividing it that much. But I think that there is so much that Hitman allows us to figure out or decide or opine for ourselves, you know, like clearly this local women's clinic that Autumn goes to is designed strictly to like try and roadblock women from getting abortions, whatever it takes, including lying to them about how far along they are so that when they finally go somewhere else, it's maybe too late. You know, but the movie, I think doesn't like deliver that stuff with a frying pan. It lets you infer it for yourself and understand it for yourself. And so I don't know. I mean, I sort of agree with Iffy in that, yeah, inherently everything is political. And because this movie doesn't come out and say like, oh, isn't abortion terrible? I'm sure that anti-choice people probably won't want to support any of it because for them, it's just like, of course we should throw all these roadblocks in and they're a good thing. And this is why they exist. And this movie is like, look, here's the reality of the situation. Here's what this one 17-year-old girl from Pennsylvania has to go through. These are all the hurdles, all the roadblocks to make it happen.
I agree that the subject matter is political regardless, because over the decades, we've made abortion a political issue versus a medical issue versus anything else. I think that Eliza Hitman spent a lot of time looking, I say fairness, not in that way of like, if you present both sides of an argument with equal weight, that's mm-hmm. fair, because I don't think that's always the case. But I also don't think she was working to demonize by overtly making, like, the woman at the women's clinic that Alonzo mentioned that Autumn first goes to is just as compassionate and seemingly mm-hmm. caring on a personal level for Autumn as the social worker that she eventually connects with at the Planned Parenthood in New York. It has a more duplicitous edge to it by virtue of what she's doing. She's like showing this video and, like you said, manipulating maybe how long her actual pregnancy, how far along she is. But the woman is, or even when they encounter the protesters in front of the clinic in New York, they're not like screaming. They're not. Do you know what I mean? They're literally like singing spiritual songs. That doesn't make them not intimidating. It doesn't mean that they don't outnumber these young girls who are probably already terrified. But she's not doing that like cartoonish thing, which I think is such I think it's a very forgiving way in for a director, because the point she was trying to make was not just about them. The point she was trying to make was what it took for this girl to have this thing done that is a legal procedure that she is allowed to do.
Another point that she made really well that really stood out to me is just, you know, we often talk about how the dangers of not having, you know, safe access to abortions. And it was very interesting seeing her go from searching the law and seeing that she needs parent consent, and the very next thing she searches is self abortion, how to give yourself miscarriage. And we kind of see her going through that. And that, like, this movie was the one that was like tough to watch, because it really is like, you know, like, because you just, there's like a grittiness to the movie in the way that it's shot too, that just can, and because it is like these kind of unknown actors, it really does make you feel this could be any woman in this country at any time right now, and just the desperation you have. And I definitely know the idea of like trying to figure something out and you can't go to your parents, and just, I think they did a good job of, I think that's one of the things that really stood out to me of why I was like, oh, it just feels like just a story. Nothing was heavy handed. Like, they gave you all the hints to kind of make you think that her father might be kind of abusive, that he, like, with this information, she might be afraid of him, you know, lashing out on her and their relationship. And like, they really do that in the first kind of part of the movie to let you know her relationship with her parents and why she can't just go to them and why she can't just ask them for help.
And also, like, the movie kind of sets up this whole sort of, like, just the minefield of being a woman in this country.
Yes.
Where, you know, yes, the stepfather is awful and we don't know what he might be responsible for. But also you have these, like, other boys at her high school. You have her creepy boss at the grocery store. So it's like, even though we don't get the answers that I think other filmmakers would feel compelled to give us, we're certainly given what her existence is like and all these different directions from which it, you know, things might have gone south and been terrible.
When you use that word gritty, Iffy, I was like, yeah, you know what's gritty? Life as a teenage girl in the United States of America. Like, it's not even a filmmaking term. Like, I heard that first and foremost as a description of this kind of way that Hitman manages to suffuse everything that we see of her life at home with this kind of ambient threat that men pose, or like ambient like desire to capitalize on her. And that part of it really I just thought was so masterfully done in a way that wasn't you know, really hitting you over the head with something that's super obvious and cartoonish, but felt very true to like a lived experience that a lot of people I know have had.
Yeah, I want to mention Sidney Flanagan and Talia Ryder. They're the two actresses who play the leads, and they're extraordinary. Talia Ryder's done some stuff and is going to be in West Side Story later this year. Sidney Flanagan, though, is a first timer who plays Autumn, and she has an uninterrupted, like, is that a close up or a medium shot? Would we say take?
Medium, you know,
medium shot. The scene that she has at Planned Parenthood that gives the movie its title is such a devastating piece.
Sorry, I'm like crying on this all over again.
It is such a devastating piece of film acting that just she takes you on a journey, and through these one word answers is telling you so much, which again, I think in the hands of a lesser filmmaker, they would have felt the need to really connect all these dots for us and draw all these lines. But like, you she's telling you everything you need to know, and it's so emotionally devastating to watch.
Her performance is incredible. I also would like to credit in that scene, the woman that plays her counselor is an actual counselor from Planned Parenthood. She was part of Eliza Hittman's initial research into it. And I looked that up especially because her delivery of the questions went so much beyond performance. I honestly can't talk right now.
That scene in particular, when I saw the trailer for this movie, which evoked in me the simultaneous feelings of I must and I will see this movie, and also like, oh my God, I'm never going to want to see this movie, like at the same time. I had this moment of, oh, I wish that were a title that were easier to remember, right? I mean, like, we just now mixed up the order of these words. And when I finally got to that point in the film and, you know, watch that incredible scene, which I agree with you, like her performance really just, I mean, I'm kind of happy I watched it at home because I could hit pause and like have a moment, you know, at several moments. But seeing that scene and as a crystallization of all of the things that we have seen her experience, right? Like watching her put the pieces together of like, actually all the stuff that I put up with every day is not okay. And the scene sort of allowing her to do for herself what we all get to do as viewers of this film, which is like see all these discrete moments as connected to how she's found herself here. Again, felt like it could have been played in a really heavy-handed way. But for me, I was just totally blown away. And I think that if you ever speak to people who do abortion counseling or, you know, I have a good friend who works with survivors of like domestic violence, actually in Minnesota. And you know, hearing their stories, it's very similar, you know, like things just kind of feel like maybe they're just happening to you or maybe they're normal until someone really pulls you out of that experience with, you know, a set of form questions or really pushes you to think about whether it's okay. And yeah, I have fully come around on the title of this film as worthwhile, despite the kind of hard to remember the orderness.
Should we vote?
Yeah, yeah, let's vote.
How do I give my gold star? Come on, Iffy.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So, you know, since we're still all in the teen, our final review of Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always would be stream it over Google Hangouts, stream it by yourself, or skip it.
I'll go first since I demanded you let me vote. This would be the highest vote for me, which is stream it over Google Hangouts. However, I would specify, I think you should stream it by yourself so that you can cry a lot and take moments as you need them. And then you should already have a Google Hangout with someone planned who has done the same thing so that you can then cry together for a while. So a two-part thing. That's, you know, it's a careful recipe. Feel free to email me about it, and I'll write that down for you. But yeah, that's my vote.
My vote is stream it immediately and then make the largest donation you can afford to the National Network of Abortion Funds or the abortion fund of your choice. That is my high praise for this film.
I recommend the Midwest Access Coalition if you're looking.
Absolutely, yes. We're screened over Google Hangouts. This is, I think certainly going to be one of the best films of the year. It is not what you think it's going to be necessarily when you hear, oh, it's about a teenage girl trying to get an abortion. Like, there's a lot more going on here. And I think really cements Eliza Hittman as a very empathetic filmmaker, especially in dealing with young people's lives. I was a big fan of Beach Rats, her previous movie. She's also an amazing eye for talent because, you know, in addition to the new actors here, like, again, Harris Dickinson and Beach Rats was so amazing. By all means, see this movie. It will put you through the emotional ringer. And yes, support your local or national abortion rights provider. They need the help.
Yes. Gonna echo that. Yep, just like everyone. Just stream it. Stream it. Recommend it. Stream it and recommend it. Like, this is definitely, I can't wait to be a corny dad and when Naomi's like a teenager, sit and watch it with her and be like, because I think that like Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always scene really is like, I think a lot of people can like listen to that and hear that and know what's not cool. It was good one. And I will say, yeah, they really did capture teenagers because I will say, the lead, like there were so many times where I'm like, oh, you're being such an asshole. And it's like, well, yeah, she's still a teenager dealing with all this stuff. And she doesn't have the concept of like, you know, of compartmentalizing and not just lashing out. And I thought that was very genuine. And it just adds to the experience of just the realness of it.
Right. Piercing your own nose as a coping mechanism for some devastating news really orients us in a time and place in someone's life. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and take another quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get into some more fun after you hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Fireside Chat on KMAX. With me in studio to take your calls is the dopest duo on the West Coast, Oliver Wong and Morgan Rhodes. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm looking for a music podcast that's insightful and thoughtful, but like also helps me discover artists and albums that I've never heard of.
Yeah, man. Sounds like you need to listen to Heat Rocks every week. Myself, and I'm Morgan Rhodes, and my co-host here, Oliver Wong, talk to influential guests about a canonical album that has changed their lives.
Guests like Moby, Open Mike Eagle, talk about albums by Prince, Joni Mitchell, and so much more.
Yo, what's that show called again?
Heat Rocks, deep dives into hot records.
Every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Iffy Wadiway. In the virtual stew with me are...
Alonzo Duralde.
Ann Friedman.
Drea Clark.
And now it's time to answer a call from the Who Shot line. Casey, play that call.
Hey guys, this is Sally from Atlanta. Love the pod. You're definitely keeping me sane in these insane times. So I was just wondering what your thoughts were on readily streaming classics. I am a person who, absent a short time in the late 80s, early 90s, aka when my parents were dictating what I was watching, haven't watched a lot of kind of classic cinema. So I would like to try to do that while I'm stuck at home. But I'm kind of limited by, you know, Netflix, Hulu, Prime, HBO, Showtime. I guess that's not that limited. That's pretty wide, actually. But your thoughts would be much appreciated, and keep on doing what you're doing. Thanks. Bye.
Ooh, well, I feel like you can definitely, you know, skip the 80s. They were still figuring things out back then.
The 80s! Oh, move away, child. Let the adults... No, I'm just kidding. I will say, I love this question, and mm-hmm. I also like the idea of people taking the time while they're expanding. Like, oh, if you're viewing more right now, to be like, well, this is the time to really crack into some classics. Or 80s films, whichever you interpret those. I will say, you didn't recommend it, but in terms of things that you would have free and easy access to with your internet is if you don't already have a library card and therefore access to Canopy, I would do that. The films that Canopy has, and they're different for each library system, but they're so much broader and more wonderful than what you're going to find on like Netflix, like Hulu for sure. Hulu has a lot of weird foreign options, but not great classics. Canopy alone, when I checked it last night, in the first two pages, if you look in their classic cinema, Cleo from 5 to 7, Rashomon 8.5, 400 Blows, His Girl Friday, The Great Dictator, Dial M for Murder, like you could go bonkers. I did find two other films on things you mentioned that I was super psyched by. The Stranger is on Netflix. It's a 1946 film. It's Orson Welles' third film. It stars Edward G. Robinson as this man who is investigating and trying to hunt down a Nazi war criminal who's in hiding in a small town in Connecticut and played by Orson Welles. And it's, I mean, I don't know if you guys have heard of Orson Welles. He was kind of a big deal, but I like it. And I don't think as many people, you know, you at this point, if you're not super versed, you're thinking Citizen Kane full stop. But I think The Stranger's a fun one to access, and that's on Netflix. And then on Amazon Prime, 12 Angry Men is on right now. It's 1957, Sidney Lumet. It stars 12 Angry Men. Go figure. My favorite of the, and the most not so angry, is Henry Fonda. And it's an incredible drama. If you're looking at like, oh, what's going to teach me about pacing, about character study, about the patriarchy in the most unexpected way, about men and how they relate to each other, how empathy can come through. 12 Angry Men stands up in some phenomenal ways. So those were the two. I'm guessing like Alonzo has like this, and Friedman surprises me in every category, as does Iffy, truly. So
okay, I will admit the Who shot line calls I usually go off the top of my head, but I went full Drea Clark and did research.
I love a good homework session.
So here's a list. Everybody get your pens out. Okay.
Ooh.
This is just a handful from each one of them. But Amazon Prime has Alfred Hitchcock's To Catch a Thief, super sexy and fun. Cary Grant, Grace Kelly at their peak yumminess. Amazon Prime has The Great Escape, which is one of the most entertaining World War II movies ever made. Iconic Steve McQueen performance. The 1974 Murder on the Orient Express, again from Mr. Sidney Lumet. A really fun Agatha Christie adaptation with Albert Finney and an all-star cast. I think way, way better than the Kenneth Branagh version. In the Heat of the Night, the Best Picture winner from the very volatile year of 1967 with Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger. And Sweet Smell of Success, a wonderfully cynical 1950s drama with Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis, one of the most quotable movies ever made. It's a riot. And if you're feeling, you know, it's a Christmas movie, or it's a noir movie, or it's an uplifting movie, or it's a depressing movie, you can watch It's a Wonderful Life. It's streaming on Amazon. Over at Netflix, they have the original The Wicker Man with Christopher Lee, which is a great horror film. Two classic spaghetti westerns, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Once Upon a Time in the West. The Burt Reynolds comedy, The Longest Yard. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which is bonkers, but like a fun, bloated 60s kiddie musical. And speaking of Orson Welles, Netflix did the restoration of The Other Side of the Wind, which is technically a movie that didn't exist in its finished form until a couple years ago, but he made it back in the early 70s, so I still count it as a classic. HBO Go has Go Tell It on the Mountain, which was a beautiful James Baldwin adaptation done for American Playhouse. They have two John Cassavetes films, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, and one of his masterpieces, A Woman Under the Influence. They have the great 1962 version of The Manchurian Candidate. They also have the remake, but whatever. And they have another great paranoid thriller, which is The Parallax View from Alan Pakula. And this is a more recent film. I think it's from like the late 90s, early 2000s, but nobody saw it. And I really love it. It's an adaptation of Peter Pan that's called Pan, from director P.J. Hogan, who did Muriel's Wedding. I love it. And then, yeah, Hulu barely has anything, but they have Jerry Lewis's The Bellboy, which is a really fun silent comedy-inspired comedy. They have the silent 1923 The Hunchback of Notre Dame with Lon Chaney Sr. And they have a shit ton of early 007 movies, including Goldfinger and On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Cinderfella was going to maybe be a recommendation. And then I rewatched part of Cinderfella and was like, no.
So I have a very simple, frothy double feature recommendation. One of which is a double up on a film already mentioned, which is the Hitchcock film To Catch a Thief, which is one of those things that I'm like, I could just watch this. Like, I always watch it when I'm sick. It always is like a beautiful scenery, beautiful gowns, you know, I mean, Cary Grant and a lot fireworks. Of neckerchiefs,
yeah.
Fireworks, like everything I really want when I am like, I just want an escapist moment. And so that would be the first of this double feature. And then the second, more Cary Grant neckerchiefs in Stanley Donen's Charade with Audrey Hepburn, which, like, speaking of junior high, this is a movie I watched with my grandmother when I was in middle school, you know, to reference our earlier conversation. And it is, you know, just a little bit of tension, like a really great Walter Matthau performance. Mm. But again, like, great looks. Like, there is an Audrey Hepburn at a ski chalet in a kind of like balaclava, like the most chic balaclava type thing anyone has ever seen. And I feel very strongly about this as a double feature. They're both on Prime, and that is just like a Saturday afternoon into evening. You're gonna forget there's even a pandemic on. Yeah. Gowns.
Love it.
I've tried to retire the term chef's kiss, but I can come up with no better way to describe that double feature.
All right. Well, thank you for everyone who's called in. The number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. And now it's time for staff picks. And why don't you start?
Okay, my pick is a film that a friend recently recommended to me that I revisit, and I have not done so yet, but I want to mention it because it was such a good idea, and that is Romancing the Stone. I am frothy picks only today, and that is what I will be doing with one evening this week, certainly.
It's so interesting trying to see Michael Douglas as a hero, like as the... Because, you know, I've already had like evil Michael Douglas in my head. So like seeing him try and be the Indiana Jones of the story was fun.
My friend who was recommending this to me told me that, and I have not verified this on the internet, so I could just be passing along hearsay, that the woman who wrote that movie got it made because she was a server at a restaurant and gave it to Michael Douglas, and then he actually read it and was like, cool, let's do it. And it was like huge hit. And then she died tragically in like a Porsche accident on the PCH. So, I mean, I can't remember her name. I'm the worst. Do you?
Diane Thomas, I want to say.
Diane Thomas. So, you know, the luckiest and most unlucky screenwriter in Ooh. Hollywood.
I have a pick that is very different from, certainly the film we talked about today. Anne will not like this film and won't watch it anyway. So, but it is one of those films that I like Google Hangout watched with someone earlier this week. And we were like, oh, this was great, because it was just mindless and stupid enough. It is Free Fire from 2011, I want to say. It's currently on Netflix. The director, Ben Wheatley, I programmed his first film at Slamdance and LAFF forever ago, Down Terrace. And he's a British filmmaker. He makes darker stuff that has a little comedic edge to it. He made another film called High Rise that I think more people would be maybe familiar with. But Free Fire is a film with Brie Larson, Armie Hammer, Cillian Murphy?
Mm-hmm. Cillian.
Yep, that cheek-boned little elf.
That's how you remember it's Cillian. It's sharp.
Oh, Cillian, sure. Charlton Copley. Like, it's a great, weird cast. The entire movie, it takes place in the early 70s. It's set up around a gun deal. So, you know, you're just hanging out with some members of the IRA, and then, like, gun dealers, you know, great people, just great people. It all takes place inside this like factory, and because of stupid things, actually this does dovetail with this in that none of these men in this film look good. They're all self-serving. They're all terrible, but it's strangely humorous for something that's just involved people shooting at each other for like an hour because unlike any, it's the anti-John Wick. All of these people are terrible shots, but everybody also gets hit several times. So everyone's like bleeding and limping. It's a very like realistic take on how stupid something like this actually would be. And man, was it a nice diversion.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that came out in 2016. I remember 16. That because, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Down Terrace is in 2011. That's why I was thinking that. Yeah.
Ooh, yeah, that's a solid. I'm going to peep that one because I remember I wanted to see it, and then I just missed it.
Lonzo's not backing me up.
Not a fan on that one, sorry. Anyway, so I've been thinking about, you know, people have been citing, like, World War II a lot lately in terms of, you know, people are actually being asked to make sacrifices, and, you know, there's a common good that we should all be trying to help out. And one of my favorite films of recent years, I think, really kind of captures that idea of what the warriors were like and how people were able to cope with them and whatnot, is a film called Their Finest, which I adored and I wish more people would watch it. It's directed by Lona Scherfig, who did An Education, and it stars my beloved Gemma Arterton as a British ad copywriter who winds up getting a job. Because, you know, as with many of the wartime industries, suddenly jobs are opening up for women because all the men have been called to serve in the military. She gets a job writing for the ministry of the government that makes propaganda movies. And she winds up finding a story of these twin sisters who took their father's boat and took it to Dunkirk to bring soldiers back, and spins it into this whole big, glorious propaganda movie. And because they're hoping that it will convince the Americans to enter World War II, because this is like 1939, you know, they put all this money into it. They're going to make it in color. They get an American star, this guy who's played by Jake Lacy, who was a war hero but cannot act to save his life. So it's a very funny movie about filmmaking, but it's also a movie that kind of acknowledges the horrors of war. There's an amazing scene where Arden is walking down the street and there's a sudden blitz bombing, and she kind of pivots from, like, you know, horror to sort of, you know, like nervous laughter to horror again in a matter of moments. You know, it is a movie that is about what propaganda films do in terms of being stirring and entertaining and, you know, like making you feel a certain way. And the movie itself kind of does the same thing in a brilliant way. So it's a really wonderful, underrated film. I want more people to see it. So you can rent it in all the places where you can rent stuff. I couldn't find it streaming for free anywhere, but Their Finest.
I will back it up. And that was actually a staff pick of mine like a year ago. Nice. That's how much I back it up. Iffy.
Hey, so for me, I tried to go a little thematic on this. Like I said, this movie was a little hard to watch for me. It was like a very intense kind of watch. Because of that, that went ahead and made me pick another movie that I remember being hard to watch that is also led by a woman, which was Maria Full of Grace from 2004, which follows a 17-year-old, also 17, Colombian woman who's desperate and pregnant. Huh? Okay. This is way more thematic. I don't miss. No. But like now she needs to make money, so she becomes this drug mule, and it's like very suspenseful. It's this whole thing, like she does the thing where she swallows all the coke, and if it, you know, bursts, it not only will it kill her but the baby. It's a whole thing. It's a very hard watch, very intense, but amazing. I enjoyed it. And now it's time for our 5-star reviews. If you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on air. All right, I'm going to see if I could do this with my, hold on. In a world where most film podcasts seem to feature hosts with the exact same opinion talking to each other ad nauseum with said opinions, Who Shot Ya breaks the mold. Iffy, Drea, and Alonzo's good humor and charm have me really looking forward to each week's episodes, and I enjoy the way they respectfully engage in a range of discourses from a serious to the silly, and from the deeply nerdy to new discoveries. The segments on the show are really well crafted, covering current news, diving into films new and old, and responding to listeners' inquiries. I'm always learning something new and challenging my own opinions on film-related matters, thanks to this awesome podcast. Thanks for what you do. I think I was only supposed to do it for the first sentence, but, you know, I just kept it going.
You rolled it. It was great.
That was from Kodode. Kodode,
yeah,
I think.
Kodode, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Truly appreciate you and that. Oh my gosh. And thank you so much for joining us. Do you have anything you want to plug?
Oh, I have a book you can pre-order called Big Friendship. Ooh. I feel like it is relevant to the theme of the movie we discussed today. It is a it is a very like friendship through the hard times book. So yeah, bigfriendship.com. That's my plug for you.
Ooh, all right. Everyone, get on it. Bigfriendship.com. And again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. Make it your quarantine activity. Calling into the show. Calling into the Who Shot line. And a reminder, you can buy a Jumbotron on our show by going to www.maximumfun.org/Jumbotron. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/Who Shot Your Podcast, or send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Lauren Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.